Hello, welcome to another episode of Cloud Security Podcast. Today, we're talking about how to become a cloud security architect in 2023 and beyond. The security architecture role has evolved quite a bit from where it used to be. If you are an experienced security architect, this is the episode for you where we talk about how you transition onto becoming a cloud security architect. Let me give you a hint on what you can expect. As a security architect with years of experience in the field, you probably are a chef who's just in a different kitchen. You still have the same tools. The short version is your skill set from the on-premise world is still valuable in the cloud world. For this episode, we had Kat Traxler from Vectra AI. She's also building a course on enterprise security architecture in the SAN space as well. So we had to bring her on to talk about how has the security architecture role changed? What are some of the challenges, frameworks people can use to build architecture in cloud? Whether they need to know coding? What's the difference between an architecture and an engineering space? So if you are someone who's starting off as well, I think this is pretty good because we had a couple of questions from the online stream about the beginning stages. So you'll definitely find this valuable from that perspective as well. And if you're someone else who's trying to become a cloud security architect or is transitioning onto that, definitely share the episode with them. I think they'll definitely find it valuable. And if you're here for a second, third, or fourth time, I'll definitely recommend following, subscribing, and maybe leaving a review and a rating on iTunes and Spotify as well, so others can find out about us as well. And we get to help out a lot more people like yourself and share the knowledge of cloud and cloud security so they can be better at their job at doing cloud security. And this is the continuation of our AWS month as well. Just a reminder, we would be at AWS reInvent. So Shilpa and I are attending AWS reInvent. And if you're there, definitely give us a shout and we'd love to say hello and take pictures and just say hello in person. And thank you for all the love that you've been sharing. Thank you for sharing all the LinkedIn posts as well as the Twitter posts and other places where you've been sharing the podcast episodes that you've really enjoyed. I really appreciate it. Shilpi really appreciates it as a producer. This is good feedback for us to know that what we're creating is valuable for you. If you have any questions about cloud security, feel free to tag us with a question on it on our Twitter, which is CloudSecPod, or feel free to drop them on our LinkedIn page or also on our YouTube channel. We are available everywhere and we are on a mission to help people democratize cloud security. So any questions you have, feel free to drop them over there as well. But as always, I appreciate your time and I hope you enjoy this episode with Kat Traxler from Vectra AI and Sans, sharing about how can you become a cloud security architect in 2023 and beyond. I'll see you on the next episode. Enjoy this and I'll talk to you soon. Peace.
By bringing developers and security together, you don't have to choose between speed and security. Develop fast, stay secure.
Hi, Kat. Welcome.
Hi, Ashish. Hi, friends. How's everybody doing?
Good. And welcome to the show. I appreciate you spending your Friday evening with us. As exciting as it would have been without me, but I appreciate you hanging out with us. All the 1,000 people over here, but I appreciate that. For people who may not know a bit about you, I doubt there are people who don't know much about you, but could you tell us a bit about yourself and where you are these days professionally and how you got there, kind of a thing?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. So my name's Kat Traxler. I'm the principal cloud security researcher over at Vectra AI. So during the day, I research cloud native attacks in AWS and GCP. I try to understand what's the attack progressions like on the cloud plane. How do attackers achieve an initial compromise? How do they move from initial compromise to recon to executing their actions on objectives? And then how can we detect those behaviors on the control plane? So that's my day job. In the evenings and weekends, I work for SANS. I'm a SANS author for the cloud security architecture course, the SANS Sec 549. So currently it's a two-day class focusing on identity architecture in AWS primarily, and we're building it out to be a four-day class starting next spring. Currently my bread and butter is in this detection engineering space in the cloud. I do have experience working in web app penetration testing. That was my very first job in security. Just working on web apps and trying to get XSS and get that hello world shell to pop. I've also worked in cloud security architecture on big e-com sites. I've worked in plain old cloud security engineering and looking at the automation process of infrastructure as code. So kind of worked the gambit in the cloud space. That tends to happen when there's so few of us who are cloud fluent. Oftentimes there's not a whole team of people where you can really specialize. Oh, here you have your cloud security engineering team, and here you have your cloud security architects, and here you have your cloud pen testers. If organizations are lucky, they have one or two people who are proficient at the cloud and they end up just doing kind of it all. So that was my lead up into moving over to the detection engineering space about a year and a half ago.
Wow. And pretty good background as well. I kind of have the pen testing space and the cloud security engineering, cloud security architecture space as well covered. Perfect for this conversation, especially because you're building a course around this in SANS as well, or you've already built a course around this in SANS. So I think, by the way, I think this is probably the first time before SANS DM Difference Maker Award. All three of us are here. Zenith is here. You are here. I'm here as well. So people who are listening in, vote for all three of us as well.
Difference makers. This is great.
Yeah, this is already difference makers. Already talking about difference maker. Security architecture is an interesting field as well, because we have a lot of people who are to what you called out. Not a lot of people have picked up the skills for cloud for various reasons. And some people may not even know what a security architect does. So maybe let's start there. How would you define the job of a cloud security, or actually not even a cloud security architect, just a generic security architect?
The primary function of any person working in security, the architect, the engineer, they work in the SOC, is just really dumb and simple. It's identifying risk within your organization and then working to reduce that risk. It's nothing more fancy than that. Each of the different roles might approach it a little bit differently, right? So the architect is looking for those larger scale design issues within how the technology is put together that might be put together in an insecure way that might create undue risk to the organization. And then from there, they have their Swiss Army knife, their basket of controls that they can use to get some of those risks or try to refactor the technology to bring it in line with what's acceptable.
Yeah. And how different is it to a cloud security architect role then?
Well, your basket of controls is different, right? So in both cases, whether you're working on a traditional on-prem architecture or your cloud architecture, you're both looking at patterns, you're both looking at the architectures, and you're saying, where's the attack surface? Where are the places that pose risk? But in the cloud, you have this whole other attack surface that you really didn't have to consider before, and that's the cloud control plane. So this whole other layer opens up that I think that maybe is initially hard to grasp for your traditional cloud security architect. All of your whole data center becomes an API. And that is now an attack surface, a risk that needs to be mitigated and controlled. So what are those controls you can layer on to this new attack surface is a whole other ballgame. And then even in your more traditional architectures, say an application deployed on some piece of IaaS infrastructure, the identity and network controls you can layer on top of that are going to be different as well. You're still creating architecture that layers on identity and network, but yep, how you do it's different.
And actually, that's a good point. Some people even yesterday, we've been running these cloud security Ask Me Anything sessions every week. And someone asked a similar question. And it was one of the things we came up with was, it's kind of like being a chef in a different kitchen. Like it's just not your kitchen. It just basically, yeah, the same tools exist, but you just have to figure out, what kind of knife is available and how do I use it? That's not my regular chef knife or whatever. But I thought it was a great analogy, because would you say you can still use the same principles of doing identity access management and doing backup and all of that, but you just have basically a different landscape to what you called out earlier?
Absolutely. Yeah. Such a great analogy. Like, you're still a chef, but it's somebody else's kitchen.
That's pretty much it. When we said that, I'm like, that is it. Like, we've been talking about this for so long. Why can't we just describe that anymore?
Absolutely. You still need to control your ingress and your egress. Like, that's still absolutely a thing. Like, you still, in the cases where previously maybe you wanted to do a network packet capture, you're still going to want to do that in the cloud where you wanted to do it in-prem. But which drawers do you pull out to get which tools out? And how to make that happen.
Yeah. That's pretty much it. Yeah. And I'm like, the moment I came out, like, can someone write this down somewhere? this is one of those ones. But
I can follow them on Mastodon. Who said that? That's amazing.
I just made that up yesterday on the call. And I was like, as I was saying it, because someone asked a question about, it was like, what do you call it? The question was around the fact that someone was a networking person in an on-premise world, looking to transition to a cloud security engineer role. And as we were trying to explain to him, and it just like came to me, and I'm like, can someone write this down? Can someone write this down? And I've been telling this to everyone, because That way I remember it myself, so I don't forget about it. Maybe I should just tweet about it. That way I could forget. I digress.
No, that's fantastic, because most of, I don't want to stereotype, but most of the classic architects that I know, they've got a little bit of gray hair, a little older, a little wiser, a little bit more mature in their career. And they see cloud come along and they think, that's for the young kids. I can't do that. It's like every ounce of your expertise, skills, knowledge about how to implement controls is needed in the cloud. We need you. We need your 30 years of security architecture experience in the cloud. Yeah, what there might be some upskilling around what this landscape looks like, but there's no substitute for that professional chef.
No, there's definitely no. I think, and all that learning you've had was still valuable, no matter how you look at it, just different. Because it's not that you can't cook anymore. You can still cook the dishes that you want to do. Yeah. Just start finding out what's available in the kitchen to kind of use. And continuing with our questioning, in terms of architecture, oh, there you go. Yeah, oh, Zenith heard that. Perfect. Yeah, I came up with it. And I think I definitely need to tweet at Zenith. I'm pretty sure I have to tweet it somewhere. Otherwise, I'll forget for sure. I was going to say, in terms of building applications itself, to what you said, we are in a different kitchen now. And we're talking about the fact that you're in a different kitchen, the same 20 plus years of architecture experience. When you're building a block of application, but what are the building blocks of building an application in AWS specifically? Because we're running AWS month. I'm sure it can be translated to other clouds as well. From an AWS perspective, what are some of the building blocks for building an application, I guess? Let's start there.
Well, I think I'm going to just kind of refocus that around like where, in what service model. We've heard about maybe the different service models, infrastructure as a service, PaaS, platform as a service, SaaS. So with the different service models, building an application in there, in the different service models can look very different, because you're going to just have control over different knobs and levers, right? So in an IaaS environment, the architectural components aren't going to look very different from, say, maybe like a VM architecture where you're on some hypervisor. They're not going to look tremendously different. Now you start moving to PaaS and you start losing control over some of those network layers. And then you have to really focus around your identity perimeter, right? So as you move through that service model, things are changing a little bit as far as what you have control over and what components you can bring to the table to affect controls.
And to your point then, would you say how in a traditional security architecture, people would talk about all these things like, oh, IAM, backup and recovery, your BCP, and all that, because they still are applicable in the cloud context as well, kind of what we spoke about earlier, right? That's not that they go away.
No, they absolutely can't. I think your backup recovery, your disaster recovery, all of that still has to matter. No large organization would agree to, hopefully to agree to move into the cloud without those mattering. You go about them differently. And it also really necessitates some foundational work to be there that I think that in an on-prem world, you kind of just like take for granted. You kind of take for granted that you're going to have these cordoned off spaces in your network to shove things. Where at AWS, you might not have those landing zones set up. So it really requires some foundational groundwork to set up the appropriate landing zones based off the risk of an application. Where do you put it in your estate?
Actually, that's a good question, because someone asked us on that AMA also, would you have a DMZ in an AWS world? Do you have thoughts on that?
I mean, yeah, of course. Like, would you have some publicly facing application? Sure. Why wouldn't you have a publicly facing application? Like, but the concept of, I'm a large organization and I have a data center and I have one or two networks is just not the concept anymore. But if you want to abstract that away and just say, like, is there going to be networks in your cloud that are publicly facing? 100%. There will be networks that are publicly facing, but it's not going to look like these mass networks that are spanning accounts. They're going to be much more segregated.
Yep. Yeah, actually, worthwhile calling off, maybe people would not even know what DMZ is. So DMZ thread zone, not the one that you talk about in North Korea, but this is like a way people have built networks for ages, where your private network is kind of like behind a DMZ. Yep. And DMZ is kind of like the public facing one, or was there another one in front of the DMZ?
I don't know. DMZ would be like your public facing zone, and then your know, your internal network would be kind of like your safe space.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. So if you, depending on the risk level of an application, a classic architecture thing to do would be you would talk to an application team, understand the risk level, and then say, okay, can it go public facing or can it get shoved in the corner, internal or external? And it's a really classic, like quick risk-based decision people have to make. And certainly you are going to be making similar risk-based decisions in the cloud, but it's not going to be as simple as here or there. It might be like this pattern or that pattern, where that pattern might have no ingress connectivity and people are just connecting through endpoints maybe. So there's going to be some slight architecture changes on how you achieve the internal network and yet maintain connectivity.
100%. And I think Zenith has an interesting take on this as well. So DMZ interface to an untrusted external network, aka the internet. That is pretty much sums it up. Yeah. So I've got a question here from Kathan as well. He's asking, I think because you have a threat detection background as well now, I've seen cyber criminals deploying crypto mining in the cloud, for example, Team TNT. Have you seen any trends in 2022 for where you see the cyber criminals focusing on for cloud exploitation? I think the reason I brought this question up is also because as an architect, you definitely need to talk or know about threats. So if you have seen any insights that you can probably share from your...
I love this question. This is the best question, especially Team TNT is my favorite threat actor. So thank you for bringing that up. It's really interesting because it's one of the very few in the wild examples we have of threat actor going after some really low hanging fruit we all have as far as cloud credentials, credentials to Kubernetes clusters, GCP session tokens, access keys. Basically, if people don't know, it's a malware. It'll affect your desktop and just like troll local files for these credentials that are just, you know, stashed on all sorts of endpoints. So yeah, I mean, that's probably the best example we have of what us security researchers know is absolutely plausible, but we don't have a ton of concrete examples around it being used in the wild. And it's problematic that we don't have a lot of concrete examples in the wild, but it's expected because we don't have really robust reporting rules, right? So there's really not a ton of incentive for people to report how they were breached, to give a really comprehensive retrospective. Those things are just so few and far between. Unless a breach just really gets out of control, they have to report it and their hand is forced. I would have to say the vast majority of them are kept pretty. So all we can do is speculate, right? All we can say is there's thousands of endpoints with cloud credentials just sitting on local files. Team TNT, we know, goes after them. Who else is going after them? I can imagine that the threat actors would be financially motivated. Absolutely. Yeah. That's one motivation. Yeah. So from there, we're imagining data exfiltration. We're thinking ransomware, probably less so risks around defacement. If you're maybe from the likes of Google, Apple, a government organization, you're thinking about state actors, also maybe like the medical industry, you're probably thinking of state actors, but that's a little bit less so. So yeah, fantastic question. I could talk to you about this all day long. It's a lot of security researchers talking to other security researchers. We're reasonable people and we can assume what might happen and what could happen and what should happen if an attacker is motivated. We just don't have a ton of examples out there in the wild.
I think, do you find it very similar to the Kubernetes space as well? Thanks for that question, Kathan, where we know what can go wrong, but how many examples are out there of actual things that, I mean, because that's where a lot of people are like, well, this is just theory, right? When was the real time this has happened? I'm like, well, it kind of can happen. So definitely a hard one.
Yeah. And without changes to the reporting laws, and I don't see how we're going to have any better data around it.
That's true. I've got another question from John F. as well. As a cloud security architect, how do you keep up with the rapid changes with cloud services?
Yeah, it's pretty wild, right? Like services are changing constantly. Services are being added. It's a scramble. I mean, it's a full-time job. It's a couple of full-time jobs. Twitter is a huge part of my life. The cloud security forum Slack channel is a huge part of my life. I've also just made ad hoc contacts with fellow security researchers who just work at different companies doing similar things that I do. And we just have meetings every couple months, like, hey, what are you working on? Hey, what are you working on? Mm-hmm. Just like foster that cooperation. Yeah. But yeah, I'm glued to the cloud news. Not only does that impact my day job as far as researching threats, but it also affects my course as I need to make sure that all of the information is accurate and up to date. It took me 2 weeks, I think, to do course updates after Reinforce. So we'll see what happens after reInvent. It might be a busy week or two after that.
Yeah, because I think with pre-event has already started. There's like a few services that have been announced by AWS. Really interesting. So yeah, you kinda, and I can already see one of them, at least the one which is to the ability to query resources all across the AWS account.
Across organizations, yeah.
Yeah, I think that would be great from a security perspective as well. I wonder if that would change the way people look at themes. Because you know, a lot of themes were used to do inventory. And now you can do inventory inside AWS, but then I don't know if that would expand to an organization level. Anyway, we're going too deep in the weed, but hopefully that answers your question, John. Did you have a point about the new service as well? I do want to let you add your piece on about that as well.
Oh, yeah, the new service. I don't know if it's going to change the way people work with SIEMs. I think that the SIEMs, they do allow you to do some of that querying across clouds. I think like SIEMPipe has a really good offering around that. But the more like enterprise-ready SIEMs around like Splunk and Elastic, those are really more about correlation between the clouds. And that's where those really shine.
Oh, actually, that's a good one. Because I think the norm of whether you are just AWS or you're multi-cloud and how many people are going to be single cloud for a long time, I don't know. That'll be only time will tell.
Nobody.
Yeah. Because same as the research we were talking about, well, we can find out as many, I guess, possible scenarios, but unless you actually have a real example, it doesn't go away. But talking about examples and how people kind of get to these kind of things leads me to IAM as well. It's probably has become the most important thing in a cloud context. Mm-hmm. Why is IAM so important in the cloud world? And yeah, I know that's your passion project as well. So can you hear your thoughts on the whole IAM space in cloud?
Yeah, we really bonded over identity, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
it's both of our loves. And I think, yeah, I mean, just referring to IAM as service from AWS IAM, it's that identity and authorization layer, that gatekeeper between you, like the end user or the attacker, and all of the functionality of the cloud. And the functionality is from spinning up new resources to destroying all of the resources to exfiltrating all of the data to encrypting all the data. It's full effect of confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So that's the gatekeeper between the end user and all of the functionality. And in most cases, by default, all that functionality is publicly accessible. So there's no network layer controls. In some more advanced architectures, you can work to put some of that behind some network controls. But in the vast majority of cases, all of that's going to be publicly accessible from any point in the world. And it's that IAM layer that's going to authorize end user access. So it's the whole ball of wax. It's the everything.
And I think OWASP even has the, what's it called? Identification authentication failure as well. The OWASP top 10, for funny enough, they've started including things which are sounding very cloud-like as well. And one of them was, I remember, identification authentication failure, which initially used to be more application-focused, but nowadays is creeping into AWS stuff as well, right?
Yeah. I love the website. I forget who does it, but it's the website that checks to see if AWS IAM has failed open.
Oh, really?
It's just this public website that just says, yes, IAM has not failed open yet. But I don't know if in the background they just start pinging something to see if it's failing open.
Failing open in the sense that would it be more as in like people can take over IAM or?
If anybody on the talk is knowing what I'm talking about, a link would be awesome or I can dig it up.
Interesting. Maybe I can share it later as well. If you can own that service, that is just basically, that's game over for entire AWS.
That's it. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, the layer that like in theory exists in on-prem worlds, like there is a management layer to VMware. So like if your organization is really big into containers and hosts, I'm sorry, virtual machines on VMware.
Yeah.
There's a management plane layer on top of that. There's a management layer on top of like HP servers. They have the lights out, the ILO interfaces that are this management plane on top of those machines. So it's not like it doesn't exist on-prem. That attack surface is there. That risk is still present. It's just on steroids in cloud because it's available everywhere. There's no network layer controls blocking that. And instead of kind of a small piece of functionality, it's now like everything. Everything is programmatically accessible.
Yep, 100%. I think now we're in a world, actually, this kind of leads me to another question where a lot of people ask about the fact that should cloud security architects know coding and automation?
I'm probably going against popular wisdom here, but I don't think so. I really don't. I know a lot of folks have said that everybody should know how to code at some point, but the security architect's job really is to understand, to be able to quickly evaluate risk and then understand how to bring it down, not necessarily how to do that implementation piece. Is it helpful if they understand a little bit to kind of be in somebody else's shoes for a minute? Absolutely. But it's not a requirement by any means. And it's, as far as the automation piece, I think automation can be used in a lot of cases to like centralize kind of like chaotic configurations in the cloud, because we have this like configuration sprawl issue. And yeah. So automation can really help centralize that. And so it's great if an architect can understand the role automation has in centralizing configurations and then have that like central policy attachment point to be able to say, okay, that's where I can prevent people from making changes to the infrastructure and only these people to make changes to the infrastructure because we're automating and we're piping through AAC. But do they know how to need to work Terraform? No.
That's a good point. Because the whole point of an architect is not to build the building, but just to build the frameworks around, hey, what, for lack of a better word, I guess, would the screw go into the hole or whatever? Like, mm-hmm. It's not about like, oh, what kind of cement should be used and what kind of metal should be. That's just too down in the weed for them.
Yeah, it's totally not necessary. I mean, you're more talking about a security engineer who needs to understand the AWS provider for Terraform and understand the difference between Terraform and CDK and how to integrate that within a CI/CD pipeline. But from there, an engineer can build this fantastic system that works great, but has no security controls as far as who can access it. So the architect needs to swoop in there and say, okay, I'm going to use this system now to put limits on who can make changes to my infrastructure. And it's good for them to know that those possibilities exist because they can try to enforce and inform that end state architecture, because otherwise we just have this like configuration chaos sprawl, and it's impossible to enforce at that point, but they don't need to implement it.
Awesome. There's questions over here as well. So Zenith is asking if it's a control plane. I think she's referring to the IAM piece. Would you say IAM is a control plane for AWS? Yeah.
Yep, control plane. Absolutely.
Awesome. All right. Thank you. Zenith, feel free to ask your question as well. What a question from Alex as well. How important are cloud certificates, for example, the AWS Solution Architect Professional?
I don't have any certs. I have lots of SANS certs, and I've always loved doing certs because it gave me this like goal and focus for my studying. I don't know that it's really, maybe it's helpful when interviewing for a job. I think that it's more important though, if you're the kind of person who needs this like end goal for studying. I want to learn about the availabilities in AWS. I want to understand all the resources. It's much easier to motivate yourself if you're studying for something. And that's what I use certs in general for. I don't know anything about the Solutions Architect cert. Once I'm done with my course, I might just go and knock off some of those just for fun. Yeah.
Maybe I can add some, because I've done the AWS Solution Architect Professional one. I think I think what you said is pretty much the answer as well there. Depending on what your goal is, Alex, if you're say wondering on the principle of you've been an architect or you are looking into going into the AWS space, if you want to understand what's an AWS service, like a generic overview of all the services within AWS, which probably are quite common. They wouldn't talk about the 200 plus services. Any common services that they know is primarily used by a lot of people across the board, they will teach you that in the associate. In the professional, the difference you find is that the question's a lot more longer and they give you a scenario. They'll say, hey, Alex, you run a $500 million company and you have a requirement to build cloud and these are specific requirements. Which one of these bullet points would you use as an approach? And that's kind of where it comes in from. I think it's good from a perspective of having an understanding of how would you use an AWS architecture. But when you're trying to Kat's point, when you're building a real life architecture, that certificate is only as good as knowing, and we're going to go back to the analogy of the chef in a new kitchen or in someone else's kitchen, where you just don't know where things are. So you're trying to figure out, based on the experience you've had in your on-premise world, you're trying to figure out, okay, what's the service for key management? Oh, it's AWS KMS. Okay, I'm going to use that. Oh, what's the service? Like, the whole conversation then becomes about, instead of drinking the Kool-Aid from AWS, because that's what they're trying to make you go down the path of for AWS solution architect professional, it's great to get a job or at least get an interview. But when it comes to real life implementation, it's probably still like you would still rely on your original skills of an architect to go make a call for, does this make sense? Because I already have a key management system in my on-premise world. Do I need to pay for another one? Or whatever the thing, the balance you need to find. Hopefully that answers your question, Alex. But I think that was my experience with it. It's good. If you have no idea about AWS, I would start with associate. Professional is a lot more harder. I even failed my first professional exam. It's crazy. I feel it's a safe space to talk about. So I failed my first professional. I had to give it a second time to pass it as well. So happy to kind of share, I think, the resources I used. But hopefully that answers your question, Alex. Thank you for that.
That the professional one was more difficult because they got a little trickier with the use cases.
Yeah.
Very, very attuned to how they're wording the use cases. You have to study the test.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a fair thing to a point also because it's not talking about all the latest services. So it, depending on the version of the exam, they might be like the versions that I gave, they didn't have a single question of Lambda. But the version after that, even though Lambda was popping at that point, everyone's talking about Lambda, but none of the solutions were pointing to Lambda. Like, well, I would not use any of these because it would not make sense. So I have to switch off my brain for what's current in AWS and switch back to what used to be in AWS and what they want to answer. So, I mean, there's a whole, we can make a whole entire episode on the whole, like, my bitch about the certification thing. I've got another question here. And I think Malik Bilal Dost is asking, he's a student who wants to go into the cloud security, cloud computing space. And maybe this is, first of all, it's awesome that you're trying to get into the space, but this is also a good point to talk about. I don't think, because he's a student, I don't imagine he has a lot of experience. What is your 2 cents on people who want to get into the cloud security space, but with no experience?
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of roles open around the junior level. I mean, my first job in the security was a junior pen tester level, and I moved from development. So there's some natural pivot points. Like if you have some background in development, well, testing web apps for security issues might be a good pivot. If you want to go into cloud security, maybe look around your organization. Is anybody doing cloud security right now? Maybe that could be you. So try to fill the holes, the gaps in the world where you see them. If you want to go into cloud security, maybe a good initial step would be to do like DevOps engineering. First know how to build it. First know how it's glued together. And then you can understand later how to secure it. So hopefully those are some good pivot points.
Yeah, I would probably throw in the fundamentals as well, just to the, I mean, not sure how much experience you have, Malik, Bilal, those, but if you can learn about networking in general, backup, identity access management, what these concepts are, fundamental concepts, because none of the AWS certifications will teach you that. They just tell you that, hey, use this IAM service, use this KMS service, but they don't tell you, why do I need a KMS? Why do I need an IAM? Why do I care about any of these? So hopefully that answers your question, Malik Bilal. And I think John F. had a link for you as well. So definitely check that out from AWS. All right, I've got a question from Roderick Risher as well. What are the most important skills of an architect?
And this is going to be an odd one, but I would say shaking hands and kissing babies. You find yourself in some really tough rooms sometimes. You find yourself in places where you need to very quickly understand, what does this application do? What risk does it bring to the organization and how to mitigate that risk? And oftentimes you have no authority to do any of that. It's just the nature of the game. So we often joked that an architect works on the 8th, 9th, and 10th OSI layers, people, politics, and religion, where you have to use those people skills to go into a room and say, hi, my name is Roderick. Please tell me about your application. I really want to know. You need to ingratiate yourself to these people. You need to be friendly. You need to care what they're doing. You need to understand what value it brings to the business. And then you need to convince them to do the right thing. that isn't going to be the case in all organizations. Some organizations, architects have a hammer they can hammer down, but I don't find that those are too frequent. I often find that the security organization, the architectural organization in particular, is this like big cross-collaboration organization where their job is to work in partnership with everybody. Yep. And they don't have a big hammer to bring down. They have to get everybody to do the right thing because they want to.
Yeah, 100%. I think I love the analogy of kissing babies. And that pretty much sums it up. Even as an auditor as well, it's the same thing as well. You want to produce a report, but you want to come back and do another audit as well. So you want to find the fine balance between what should be reported to high risk versus a medium risk. Mm-hmm. And that conversation never changes. Thank you for that question. Mm-hmm. The question, what SANS certificate do you recommend for transitioning to or geared towards a cloud security architect role?
I have, I think, 5 SANS certs. I kind of lose track. I think most recent one was the one based off of the 510, the cloud security, multi-cloud security assessment course, SANSEC 510. Great course for all around understanding the secure configurations of the AWS and Azure. Fantastic course. I contributed part of it, so it was pretty fantastic. Great cert. I keep coming back to my very first one, though, the SANS 401. It's just a security essentials. It's kind of like their equivalent of the CASSP. Very broad, not a ton of depth, but it really is those just fundamentals around CIA, confidentiality, integrity, and availability across all technology systems. Yep. And I studied like mad for that for 3-4 months. And I really attribute the solid foundation I built from that first course and that first cert to be able to kind of like build from there. So anybody first starting out, I always recommend the 401. It was a hard class. And wow. It was a really, really hard cert to study for. So yeah, I mean, it is a 400-level course, so maybe somebody might turn their nose up at it, but it is some solid foundations to get anybody started.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing that. Thanks for that question as well, Zita. Talking about CSSP you dropped in there, I feel like a lot of people would be, I guess, thinking about how it has the broad context for cybersecurity in general. And we spoke about certifications. That's also making me think that it, with regards to clouds as well, these days, not many people are, especially if you're in the enterprise space, you don't just have one cloud, you have multiple clouds. And sometimes you have private cloud and public cloud and, I don't know, whatever cloud someone else has just happened to make in their basement somewhere. And do you feel it is important for a cloud security architect to know all the clouds, at least in some way or form?
I think that is the idea that a cloud security architect would have this, like, I would say, deep understanding of all the clouds is just ridiculous. I can't imagine anybody has enough RAM in their brains to contain all of that and specialize in one, really go deep in one. If you're an overachiever like me, you can specialize in 2. But focus your specialization on like 1 common or 2 common languages. For me, it's AWS and GCP. And then every time I have to try to understand a concept in Azure, how I understand those concepts is I draw parallels between. And I start saying, oh, this is like VPC service controls, or this resource model is like GCP, but with this variation. So you can start to get some proficiency, at least baseline proficiency, pretty quickly.
Yep,
if you are just deep in one. But don't think that you have to have this deep experience in all 3. I think it's kind of ridiculous to expect that from anybody.
Yeah, the same. I started with AWS, and I think I still feel I'm the most in my element in AWS, but I can definitely transition to Azure, Google Cloud. As much as I've done, that transition has always just been to what you said. I've drawn a parallel to go, okay, what was the parallel for this in AWS? Ah, this is the unique way it works. What you can call the service, whatever you want, because to your point, there might be a 4th cloud tomorrow. Suddenly Oracle Cloud becomes popular or IBM Cloud becomes popular. I mean, how many cloud services can you really remember? Like, back in the day, people used to have 1 certificate from Cisco, and that would be the best for the rest of their life. That's not enough anymore.
And that's why, get a certificate if you want, don't get a certificate if you don't want. And it's just a tool to help you learn. That's all it is.
I definitely feel like the certificates at the moment in the cloud space have become more of a tool to get that next interview. Because to what you said, you may have learned cloud security in your organization without a cloud security title, but you're trying to get that role somewhere, then that certification actually helps. Because then that gets you the entry, because whatever filter people have for, hey, I only want people who are AWS certified or Azure certified or Google certified, at least you pass that filter and get to the interview part when you can really shine at that point.
I understand that, right? A lot of people have software that looks at all the resumes. Yeah, yeah. There are these keywords in there.
Yeah, because they're looking at thousands. I mean, that's most of the people that I've helped out and spoken to. That's what they keep referring to, that you can't even get to the pass at first filter if you don't have certificates. I'm like, okay, fair enough. That kind of explains the reason. But if you're in a company where there are already plenty of cloud security roles, you don't need to have a certificate. You just basically work your way through transitioning onto that role within the company.
Yeah, and I bet there's tons of people who are working in the cloud space without that official title, because there's so much cloud and so few official practitioners. So it's going to fall in so many people's laps.
Yep, 100%. This also makes me feel, talking about frameworks around how architecture space has always been about, I think as Isaka or whatever, there's like a SIG. There's a few frameworks people rely on for building architecture. Are there any frameworks that apply to a cloud security world as well? In terms of, hey, I can go back to this framework and use that as a building foundation, or should people just use to adapt MITRE as a way to go, oh, these are my TTPs and I will work on based on that. What do you normally recommend to people for building architectures?
So, I mean, to get really like high level and to get really kind of ephemeral around your architecture and to get into like the architect's architecture, I love SAPSA. I don't know if you've heard of that. It's out of the UK. I base a lot of my formal architecture training around the SAPSA methodology, which is very business oriented, attempting to drive outcomes from your architecture rather than just ratchet up the security, make it super secure. So that's not cloud security architecture. That's just architecture, security architecture in general. And it's a very like traditional formal methodology. I don't think you should show up to your next job interview with the big formal SAPSA book and say, I'm going to prescriptively make everything this way. But it's a really good framework and way to think about things. As far as just like reference architecture and understanding what secure patterns look like in the cloud, AWS has their well-architected framework, which is a guide that will talk to you about some really common use cases. Like if you want to connect your VPCs on-prem, what are the patterns? If you want to connect two VPCs together, what are your use cases? What's the pattern? And they also have a website, the well-architected labs, you can walk you through all of these different labs of building networks and creating identity architectures and roles. And there's different pillars they work on, not just security, but also like cost and performance and things like that.
Oh, sweet. That's a good idea. I'll put the notes for them in the show notes as well, so people can actually find out about it as well. I've got a question here from, I think this is more around the software development side. And the question is more on the fact that, thanks for your question. Aside pen testing, do I need to know software development networking as fundamentals to reach cloud security or cloud computing?
Yeah, I mean, networking fundamentals, absolutely. Understanding the difference between public and private IP space and routing and probably even how to do some CIDR math, some basic networking concepts. Maybe the software development lifecycle, it's nice to be exposed to, well, I guess I'll make the joke. How does a bill become a law? How does an application become an application? I think it's really important to understand that process between somebody writing some JavaScript on their computer and it being packaged and committed to a Git repository and picked up by a CI/CD system and deployed into a container, and then maybe the between dev and prop. Just that whole life cycle system, and then like the places where security plugs into it. All of those things you're going to learn, I think, probably in the first day of your job, in the first year or two. Those are things you just soak up by osmosis, by kind of living and working within security. And if you find yourself in an organization that'll let you get exposure to a lot of different areas, hopefully you'll just kind of pick that up.
Hopefully that answers your question as well, but that answered the question really well. I think the last question that I had was, is there more of a roadmap kind of a thing that you kind of tell folks who are trying to transition over from an experienced architecture role onto a cloud security architecture role? Is there like usually some kind of a mind map or a roadmap to what we spoke about. Some people love having those milestones that they can tick off as they, oh yeah, I can do these things and I'll probably get to that cloud security architecture thing. Is there any rough roadmap that you normally recommend to people for how they can approach that?
I mean, not offhand, no. I mean, I hope that's what I'm building. Ashish, I hope that's what I'm building is a roadmap. I feel like in that roadmap, I hope that people take away more about what to retain, about their intuition around mitigating risk and designing for confidentiality, integrity, and availability. I hope within that roadmap that I create that what people, their takeaways is that they already have that intuition in them from the on-prem world. They just need to know how to translate it.
Yep. Yeah. And that's a good way to kind of put it as well. Because I think whatever they know right now is still very important. Yeah. One more question coming from Roderick. What is the most difficult thing about cybersecurity when related to architecture?
Oh, the most difficult thing about security as it relates to architecture, I think it is probably staying humble and understanding that as security professionals, as security architects, we're there to high risk, mitigate risk, but we're also there to help the business with whatever that application is there to do. So you have a team of developers that have developed this architecture and they want to deploy it onto the web because it's going to make your business X amount of dollars. Your job isn't to put all the security on top of it and just security it up. It's to walk alongside of them and to understand what is it doing? What purpose does it serve? Who are its users? What's the business value? And all of that requires a lot of like humility. It requires a lot of shaking hands and kissing babies. It requires just a lot of like getting to know people and what they're trying to accomplish. So I think the really easy default thing is to just plop security on something and just say, it's call it a day. Mm-hmm. But we need to more understand what the purpose of this thing is to understand what needs to happen to it.
Yep. I think that the way I put that as well, it's very well said as well. I think the way I put that across is when we're all starting off in cybersecurity, we want to quote you, security everything, because hackers are out there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But once you start having a bit more experience, you realize actually we're in a role in a company because the company is paying us money to mm-hmm. get our advice and guidance on what our risk exposure is. How can you manage it? How can you mitigate it? It is not to securityfy everything. As much as it is like a byproduct of identifying the risk, it is not the goal. Yep. Just that it, unfortunately, and it takes you some time to realize. So I'm not sure how much experience Roderick has, but as you kind of go along the journey of becoming an architect, what you realize slowly is that the whole shaking hand, kissing baby thing, which is true, because you may decide that, oh, these 10 things are in that list. If I do all of these, this application will be secure and best of scale and everything. But out of that, those 10 things, only 3 or 4 can actually be implemented practically. And people may say yes to. Everything else would be a no. How do you deal with that? How do you even check your ego while people are, like, you've spent so much time and research looking at the 10 things and now suddenly, like, I can only do 4? Like, are you serious? So yeah. I normally find that was very humbling for me when I was an architect, that I had to all consistently check my ego for, that's okay. They understand what they're doing. I've done the right thing. I'll move on from this. What do you think about that?
Oh, no, that's perfect. Yeah. Just being very conscious of the ego. I mean, it's going to come up. It's going to happen. You're going to feel like, oh, somebody's not respecting my authority.
I've done so much research. I know all of this. I know AWS certificate.
Yeah. What do you mean you can't do that? What do you mean that's going to take 6 months?
There's a lot of that. A lot of brain power spent on kissing babies and shaking hands. Let's just say that.
Yeah. So really being very tactical about what you ask for and making sure it has the biggest impact on that risk mitigation.
Pretty much it.
Yeah.
And this is where the alignment of business goal comes in as well, to your point about the tactical mm-hmm. part. As long as your tactical steps are towards what the business wants, it would be an automatic yes.
Yeah.
The moment it's like slightly off what business wants, like, oh, let's work on it next time, or let's find mm-hmm. another way to do this or something. So, but I loved how both you and I were able to kind of like come up with a great answer for Roderick. If you have any further questions, feel free to ask that as well, Roderick. But thank you for that question. That was a great question.
That was a great one.
Yeah. All right. That was like pretty much the end of my technical question. I've got three fun questions and it won't take that long. And also it's more just to get for people to know a bit about yourself. First one being, what do you spend most time on when you're not working on cloud or technology?
My yoga studio. Yeah, every minute. I mean, that's how I recharge right now. Right now I'm exceptionally busy, and where I recharge is the yoga studio. It was some long COVID times when it was closed. It was real tough, but it's open again, and that's where I find my energy.
Wait, is this one of those yoga places where they give you wine and tea as well, or?
No. That sounds lovely. No, I don't want to do that.
I've always wanted to try a yoga place where they give you wine. I don't know how you do poses with wine in the belly. That would be just weird. I think it'll be weird to do that. But I think it's a fun activity as well. So I'm glad. Thank you for sharing that.
I can see some tea, though. Some tea would be really nice.
Tea would be good. But maybe after the yoga, right? Not in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people start during COVID, they started the whole, yoga with wine. And
it doesn't seem practical at all.
No, it wasn't. Like, so you do a few poses, you stop, you drink alcohol you drink wine, which is still an alcohol, and then you go back into poses again. I'm like, oh, by the end of it, are you even able to do your poses?
Is this just an Australian thing?
Maybe an Australian thing, but we definitely came up with interesting ways to drink, I guess. But it definitely got a lot of popularity because of it. That's why a lot of people helped us get through the COVID times when we are in lockdowns. Next question, what is something that you're proud of but not on your social media?
Something that I'm proud of that's not on my social media. Oh man, that's a hard one. Okay, I'm gonna get real personal here, but this is a safe space. My sister is 13 years younger than me. So she was like a daughter, right? And actually, as we grew up, I ended up having legal custody of her. So she is a little bit like my daughter. And she has just like blossomed into this like wonderful woman, mom. She graduated nursing school. She like has her own house now. She's just like kicking ass at life and being wonderful. So I'm most proud of my sister.
That is a great answer. And I'm really proud of your sister as well. That's pretty cool that she's all gone through all of that and made an amazing person of herself. Mm-hmm. Awesome. And just on that, Zenith can just came. They're doing yoga with goats as well.
I've seen that. Yeah. And the goats are like walking on your back. Yeah.
Oh, really? Is that what they're doing? Oh, okay. Fair enough. This is, well, COVID has made people weird, I guess. The yoga with wine and yoga with goats. So there you go. Finally, talking about goat and goat cheese, I guess. What's your favorite cuisine or restaurant that you can share?
Oh, I think I said this last time, but I think I said Mexican food, right? Absolutely my favorite. We have like this little like Mexican bodega down the street. And when neither of us want to cook, we're just like, let's go over and grab a plate of huevos rancheros or something.
Ooh.
It's like the place is a parking lot mess, right? Because there's like every contract pickup truck trying to get into this parking lot. I think the city probably sent them letters about the traffic jam it causes, but we love it.
Oh my god. Well, I think definitely great Mexican food in America for sure, though. That was probably what we had time for. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Where can people find you to know more about cloud security architecture and the courses you're working on and stuff as well?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter and Mastodon. NightmareJS is the handle on both. I'm on the InfoSec Exchange Mastodon Twitter now. Like a lot of people, I'm kind of making the migration over to Mastodon. I'm liking it so far. It's not too bad. I'm also on the Cloud Security Forum Slack run by Scott Piper. You can talk to me there. Or LinkedIn always works. So.
And the SANS course that you're working on, what's that called again?
Yeah, the SANSEC 549 Enterprise Cloud Security Architecture, 2-day course now. Beginning of the year, it'll be out to a 4-day course.
Sweet. Looking forward to that. Awesome. Thank you so much for that. I'll leave a links for all your socials over there, including the course as well. But thank you so much for coming in. And thank you for everyone else who tuned in as well and asked those questions. And we'll see you in the next episode. But thank you so much for your time. And I hope you have a great weekend, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks. Bye.